Oh, here it is.
Sorry, how do I ask
you? No problem. I'd rather settle for the introduction that you gave me. You used your time well. Well, it's great to be here. Thank you for the invitation, and thank you for that nice introduction. I have to say, coming to APHA these days, and being a boy, you feel like a minority, but being in this room, you feel like an endangered species. great introduction to climate change and health. My task, I think, is to talk about the role of government in addressing climate change and health issues. So I want to talk about the public health response that we at CDC think underlies our response to climate change. And I'm going to take the liberty to make some suggestions about special areas where I think nursing expertise can make a difference, make an important contribution. And then I'll review government initiatives at the global, federal, state, and local initiatives, and close by talking about partners with whom we need to work, and try to do it all in 10 minutes. I'm not going to review this. You've probably all seen slides like this. This is a slide about the various health impacts of climate change. Barb talked about them beautifully. They've been well cataloged and well published. And for those who would like to learn more about these, if this is a new area for you, there are plenty of good papers that I can recommend or you can find on the CDC climate change website. There is an emerging body of thought about what our public health response to climate change needs to look like. And the action that Barb so eloquently called for needs to be organized, of course. And at CDC, we have come to think that it can be organized using the tools that are in the public health toolbox already. This is a picture that you've seen, and if not the picture form, you've seen a list. It's the core functions of public health. And it turns out that although this is a huge challenge and in some ways an unprecedented challenge, many of the steps that we take to address other public health problems are very appropriate to apply to climate change. So, for example, the monitoring health function. Collecting data is key in public health, as it is in clinical care of patients. Collecting data regularly on environmental trends that may impact human health and on human health outcomes that may be related to climate change is going to be a core function for us. The diagnose and investigate function, looking at outbreaks of waterborne disease, foodborne disease, vector-borne diseases that we think may increase in frequency with climate change. The inform, educate, empower function is the public health communication function, and this is one on which I want to linger for a moment because this is such a key skill set for public health nursing. How many here were at the session just earlier today on communicating climate change? It was a lunchtime session. So a few of you were, most weren't, and I'm going to go ahead and take the liberty to talk about that for a moment. Mobilizing community partnerships outside the health sector. This is another example of being outside our comfort zone. If you're comfortable working with other healthcare providers, as most of us are, that's great. If you're comfortable working across the public health sector, that's great. But arenas like the faith community, or like planners or transportation people or energy policy people, are the ones with whom we have to work now as we develop the right responses to climate change. Developing policies and plans, an example is the heat wave preparedness planning to which Barb referred. We know that we can save lives and protect public health with adequate preparedness. And putting those steps into place, drilling them, exercising them, evaluating them, modifying them is key. Assuring a competent workforce, we really need to be training those who come after us to deal with climate change. The research function is very key. There's an awful lot we still don't know exactly which infectious diseases are likely to emerge and what will the patterns be that characterize their emergence, what are the demographic predictors of responses to heat waves, and so on and so forth. What are the solutions? And we need to test them and verify them as we put them in place. What are the health implications of various preventive policies that we put in place? And how can we optimize health as we address climate change? So these are standard public health tools. Nothing I've said here is unfamiliar to anybody in the room, but they apply very nicely to climate change as well. Now, in the climate change world, the responses are sometimes conventionally divided between mitigation and adaptation. Mitigation refers to the primary reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, what we call primary prevention in the health sector. Adaptation refers to reducing the harm caused and dealing with the realities of climate change to which we're already committed. We might call that preparedness in the health sector. Lots of people think that the public health role mainly will focus on adaptation, and that is indeed a very important public health role. And I'll talk about that, but before getting to that, I want to linger for just a minute on mitigation, on primary prevention. There are at least a couple of public health roles. One is that we can deal with our own sector. We can deal with the health sector. It's one-sixth of the economy. It's an energy-intensive one-sixth of the economy. The energy usage in a square foot of healthcare facility space is about twice the average commercial space energy usage. So if we can work within our own sector to reduce energy consumption and otherwise to achieve environmental efficiency, we're doing a lot to address climate change, and we're setting an example. We're becoming leaders in our communities. So the whole notion of green healthcare is a very, very good arena, legitimate arena for us to work in. Nobody would question the appropriateness of healthcare professionals or health professionals working toward green healthcare. The nice piece of it is that it offers collateral benefits. Not only do we achieve better environmental performance, but we have more and more data that green healthcare facilities also predict better patient care, fewer staff errors, less staff turnover and absenteeism, and lower costs. So there's lots of wins in the green healthcare arena. The other area where we can and should engage mitigation is in all of the strategies that we'll need to adopt as a society to address climate change. So we'll need to shift to different sources of energy, we'll need to move to conservation strategies, and so on. Each of these is referred to as a wedge. Has anybody seen this concept of climate wedges? Some of you have. So the notion here is that on our current trajectory, we're moving up that top line. This one. That's a continuation of increasing CO2 and greenhouse gas emissions as we've been seeing over the last century or century and a half. What we'd like to do is bend that line and achieve a steady stabilizing of greenhouse gas emissions and ultimately a decline. Well, there are existing technological options, each one called a wedge, and you can see that they're called wedges because they help bring us from the upper curve to the lower curve. Each of those wedges, in turn, has consequences. There are costs, there are benefits, there are health threats, and there are health advantages. We need to analyze each of those so that we can choose the best mitigation strategies. Health won't be the only driver of those decisions, but we do need to provide the health data to decision makers so that the most health protective strategies can be identified and adopted. We can use techniques that are available to us, like health impact assessment, to do that. So at least a couple of major ways in which the health sector needs to engage mitigation, through greening our own sector and through assessing the health consequences of mitigation strategies. Much of what we'll do has to do with adaptation, and I talked about the various public health steps that comprise adaptation. I want to pause and talk about the communication piece. This is something that public health nursing is so good at and can lead a lot of the efforts, in my view, that the health sector will take. We know that there are mental health consequences to climate change. Some of those occur in response to the disasters that climate change will bring. So here are some headlines from after Katrina, indicating that the mental health burden was enormous and continues to this day and may actually turn out to be the largest health burden of Katrina. And that's saying a lot. We had a fair number of deaths and we had a lot of other interruptions of medical care and so on, but the long-term mental health burden of displacement is enormous. That's only one of the mental health consequences of climate change. The other one is one that I want to discuss by showing you what may be a surprising picture. This is the nuclear bomb going off in Hiroshima in 1945. And those of us who grew up immediately after that event remember air raid drills. Who remembers air raid drills? So, oh boy, we're all in the same generation here. So for those who are too young, here's what we did. We were sitting in school, and the siren went off, and we all followed instructions. In my school, Krieger Elementary, we ran into the basement. In some schools, there was no basement, so you simply got under your desk, and you assumed the position that you see here. You were supposed to bend over and hug your knees and look at a part of your anatomy ordinarily not looked at during school. And that would protect you from the effects of the Soviet Union dropping the nuclear bomb. These children did not follow instructions. The girl is looking up instead of looking down, so she will be a victim of the bomb. And these children did not properly get under their desk all the way, so they'll be protected from the waist up, but not from the waist down. Well, I'm making light of this. You can imagine that this was not a cheerful prospect under which to grow up back in the 1950s. We knew that our world might be destroyed at any moment, so much so that we practiced for it. We're seeing possibly similar narratives in circulation now. Here are a couple of articles, one from the Washington Post, one from the BBC, the results of intrepid reporters going to elementary schools and looking into the kinds of stories that kids hear, how they understand them, and in these particular cases, the kinds of pictures that kids drew after studying climate change. And what they found was the kids were drawing pictures of the world melting and of megafauna dying and so on. Very, very depressed pictures. It's no wonder. So the stories that we tell about climate change are both important because we need to get information out and motivate action. They're also powerful and scary and apocalyptic. I'm going to skip over this because we're running a little short on time. Health communication matters a lot. And if we tell the stories incorrectly, we know that we can elicit some responses we really don't want to elicit. This is an example of probably the way not to communicate about climate change, telling apocalyptic stories out on the sidewalk. This is an example of hectoring and accusation, probably also not very effective as a way to communicate climate change. I don't know who that is standing there. This is a story of badgering. Stop whining about your heart, Dorothy says. Your selfish addiction to fossil fuels is endangering all of us. This is a picture from Jonathan Patz. It's an example of misinformation. If you read the sign carefully, it says the sign has sharp edges. Don't touch the edges of this sign. Also, the bridge is out ahead. So imbalanced communication of information is not a good way to communicate. Exaggeration is not a good way to communicate about climate change. This is otherwise my favorite scientific journal. You can get it when you're standing in line at the supermarket, but the 150-foot figure is probably not accurate. If we get it wrong, we elicit reactions like the one shown here. This is from The New Yorker. This past summer, the woman says to her friends, "I got deeply depressed about our planet as if I didn't have enough problems of my own." Depression. Hargrove shows up at the boss's office wearing his personal flotation device, and his boss says, "Hargrove, what's all this I hear about you're living in constant fear of polar ice caps melting? Depression, fear, hiding our heads in the sand." You've probably seen Edvard Munch's famous painting, The Scream, which you may not know that it was part of a series that Edvard Munch did called Edvard Does Climate Change. So there was despair, there was anxiety, there was the scream. And perhaps worst, there's this reaction. This is, anybody know who this is? Yeah, this is Nero. He is often said to have been fiddling while Rome burned. It was actually a harp that he played. I was there and I saw it. But this is what we don't want to elicit either. So we need to devise better ways of communicating. We're pretty good at communicating tough news in the healthcare world. After all, we're the ones who tell people to get a colonoscopy and wear a condom and stop smoking and eat less food, sometimes all at the same time. And those are hard messages to hear. Some of that skill set is going to be adaptive to climate change. Some of it is not going to be transferable to climate change because, for one thing, and this came up in the communication session earlier today, those behavior changes that we're accustomed to communicating offer direct benefit to the person who changes his or her behavior. If we ask people to take steps to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions and reduce their carbon footprint, those steps won't always benefit them directly. In some cases, they'll benefit the community, they'll benefit future generations, but the direct personal benefit may not be so clear. So we have some skills at communicating. We have some challenges at communicating. We need to think hard about this. The session today was an example of research being done in this area. I like a couple of the points that are made in this book called Breakthrough, which is a book written for environmentalists by environmentalists, calling the environmental movement to task for not framing the messages very well. Two points are especially relevant. One is the point that I've quoted here. Think of the verbs associated with environmentalism and conservation: stop, restrict, reverse, prevent, negative verbs. What the authors point out is that those don't stick very well. We really need to move toward positive aspirational messages instead. Those have much better traction with the public. The example they use is this famous speech, which did not go this way, and if it had gone this way, it might not be as memorable as it is. Instead, it was a positive aspirational speech and one of the great speeches in American history. The second point they make that I want to report to you is this: the challenge of climate change is so massive, global, and complex that it can only be overcome if we look beyond the issue categories of the past and embrace a grand new vision for the future. In other words, they say, environmentalism has become a special interest. It's one of many special interests that are out there contending for the attention of the public. And as we heard earlier this morning, there's very good polling data showing that most Americans recognize climate change as a problem, and most Americans take it seriously and would want something done about it. But if you ask them to rank it on their list of priorities, it's number 20 or 30. It doesn't rank very high. But if you marry climate change with other issues that people care about more, economic security, security on the streets, a future for their children, good education, and so on, then that may make this an issue with much more traction. So let me finish by talking about governmental efforts at several scales, and as I do it, I will keep an eye on the pasta arriving, so you don't have to, don't worry. At the global level, a lot of the global work on climate change is being carried out by intergovernmental organizations, the World Health Organization, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and others. There is a real focus in these bodies on the countries of the South, the poorer countries, developing countries, whichever term you like, where the impacts will be enormous and where there is much less of a resource base and much less resiliency to deal with climate change. So there is an arena that's very important to deal with, and especially for those who work in international public health, this is the place to plug in. There is both technical assistance and research underway at these forums. At the federal level, a number of agencies are actively engaged in climate change in general. Fewer agencies are engaged at the interface of climate change and health. The earth sciences dominate a lot of the work, but the Department of Health and Human Services, both CDC and NIH, have been working more and more on this interface. EPA has a very good track record, and other agencies such as NOAA have from time to time worked at the interface of climate change and health. All of those agency efforts are pulled together under an umbrella called the Climate Change Science Program, the CCSP. That program was actually an outgrowth of a creation more than 20 years ago. And it's changed over time with different political administrations. It's likely to change in a couple of weeks as well. And so it's worth keeping a close eye on that and watching the way the Climate Change Science Program nationally will evolve. There also is a bill in Congress now to establish a National Climate Service, which would be like the National Weather Service under the auspices of NOAA, that would collect a lot of information about climate change and make that available through a single gateway to the public and to decision makers. So your best points of contact in terms of dealing with climate change and health issues at the federal level would be CDC, and then I think to a lesser extent NIH, although their efforts are stepping up. EPA is doing very good work now, and I'm happy to help anybody who's interested find those contacts. There are lots of state-level efforts. Many states have shown leadership, and you can access that through the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials, which organizes a lot of these efforts. Individual states often have portals. I'm showing you the California portal here. And the National Governors Association has a major effort on climate change generally that does extend to the health consequences of climate change, too. So either through national associations of the states, like NGA or ASTHO, or through your state government itself, probably the health department and or the environment department, you can access state-level activities. And then local efforts are very, very worthwhile. Lots of these steps we need to take have to do with adaptation and preparedness at the local level. There's a very, very admirable effort of hundreds of cities across the country led by their mayors to address climate change, and a number of local public health officials are very much involved with that. So it's quite likely that your city, if you live in a major city, is part of that effort. I'm showing some examples here. You can go to the Mayor's Climate Protection Center at the U.S. Conference of Mayors, or NACHO, the National Association of City and County Health Officials, and both of those will take you into local efforts dealing with climate change. A couple of examples here from each side of the country, Portland on one side and New York on the other side, are very nice examples of work going on locally. So there are many opportunities at all the scales that Barb mentioned for you to get involved. I guess I would echo the need to be uncomfortable, to aim for as high as you feel possible. And as you do that, to be uncomfortable in terms of the partners with whom you work. You'll have to work with people that you're not accustomed to working with. So those of us in health need to reach out to the many other kinds of groups that are listed here, and I would urge you to do that. Nurses have amazing moral authority and amazing traction in bringing a message forward, so I commend this work to you in the strongest possible terms. Thank you very much for the concern that brings you here today.